Welcome back to Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. If you're new to the show, thanks for listening. I'll be your guide to a behind-the-scenes look in our newsroom. Now, normally I do some sort of intro here, previewing the topics we'll go over in our show. Today, however, I'm just going to jump right into it. Once I get rolling, I think you'll understand why. A majority of the articles you read in the Journal Sentinel focus on people and issues located right here in southeast Wisconsin. But occasionally, a topic arises that requires us to travel, to dive deep into a story, no matter where it is. Such is the case in the next piece. When a group of local doctors and professionals decided to embark on a humanitarian mission to Jordan, to aid Syrian refugees, it became clear that traveling with them to cover their journey was crucial. We needed to be there. Photojournalist Mike DeSisti talked to fellow photographer Mark Hoffman about the trip to Jordan he's taking with reporter Mark Johnson. They discuss all that goes into traveling overseas to cover a story like this.
While much has been written on the Syrian refugee crisis, far less has been reported about the health problems faced by refugees, and less still about the mental health impact, especially on refugee children. Photojournalist Mark Hoffman, along with reporter Mark Johnson, are in the middle of a trip overseas to Jordan, where more than 600,000 of the refugees are living. They're observing a humanitarian mission, where a group of doctors from Children's Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin will be working in a neurology and mental health clinic, which deals with refugees suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, seizures, developmental delays, and other conditions. I talked with photographer Mark Hoffman about the trip before he left, which is funded by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Just a day in paradise.
Tell us about this trip you're going to be taking.
Myself and reporter Mark Johnson are doing a story about a group of people from the Milwaukee area who are going to work with Syrian refugees in the camps in Jordan. They're led by a pediatric neurologist, Tarif Bakhtash, who is Syrian-born and just feels real passion towards the Syrian people and all the heartache and the trauma and the violence and displacement that these people have gone through. In fact, he quit his job recently, so he's looking for a new job that would allow him to take 2 months off a year so he can work with Syrian refugees. Currently, he works with Syrian refugees every Wednesday morning at 6 in the morning. He treats refugees via Skype in Syria, and it's kind of, you know, frontier medicine in a way. It's telemedicine at its most basic, but he does that for free just because of the passion he feels. One of the reasons why we also wanted to look at the story as well is, you know, there's a big debate over immigration in terms of Syrian refugees coming to the United States. Currently in the United States, there's slightly less than 2,600 Syrian refugees in the whole country since the war started in Syria. And currently, only about 3 are in Wisconsin. And so who are these people? You know, why are they fleeing? I mean, they get caught up in this rhetoric in the presidential campaign, should we let them in or should we let them in? We want to take a look at who these people are and, you know, what are really the facts rather than the rhetoric behind the case.
So tell me about the trip. You've done interesting things as a photographer in your career. You've covered Super Bowls. Have you ever traveled overseas like this before?
I've never been to the Mideast before. I've covered the war in El Salvador. I've done conflict in Haiti before. But this won't be anything like that. I mean, Jordan's like the most peaceful country in the Middle East. I'd worry more about, you know, being injured driving my car in Milwaukee than I would be in Jordan. So I think when people hear the word Middle East, they automatically think conflict and violence, but that's not the case. I mean, the refugees are fleeing violence and that type of thing, but the country of Jordan itself is very peaceful. One of the big challenges that we're going to have is I don't speak Arabic, and we will have a translator with us. So one of the things I did is I had business cards printed up in Arabic, so at least explains why I'm taking their photograph. You know, in countries that come from authoritarian regimes, they're very suspicious of why are you taking my picture? How do you break that ice when I don't speak Arabic and they might not speak English? And I thought that would help me quite a bit.
So when you got the business cards, how did you know for sure that they said what you wanted them to say? Because you can't read Arabic, so.
Well, we hired a translation service in Chicago, and they translated them for us. And then I've had 3 people who speak Arabic look at them as well. So measure twice, you know, just make sure it's correct.
So what kind of preparations do you have to do as far as like packing your photography gear? Do you do anything special when you're taking a big trip like this? Do you need special equipment or anything? Or
I actually pack a lot less than I would for a typical football game. You know, what I tell people when readers call up and they'll say, what kind of camera should I get? And I'll tell them all the time, I said, I've missed more photos in my life from having too much equipment than not having enough. So for the most part, I'm packing a lot less than I do for football. I'm not packing really long lenses because I'm looking for intimacy. So I'm looking for a wide angle lens. I want to be that proverbial fly on the wall. And I'm also packing some video equipment and that type of thing. But really what you want to do in documentary photography is you want to capture those moments that otherwise slip between the cracks. And that's hopefully the images that I'll produce while I'm there.
While you're in Jordan, it is a peaceful place. You are relatively close to the Syrian border. Do you have any concerns?
None.
No?
None.
Okay. Why not?
Because I'm in Jordan, not in Syria.
Are you going to go near Syria? Or?
I would love to. Actually, one of the things I would love to do, this doctor who's going, one of his goals next time is to actually go into Syria. And they work in like a lot of underground hospitals, but most of those are over by the Turkish border. And their healthcare system has basically been run amok. So these people are basically, it's almost like a MASH unit that's underground. And they're hidden, you know, so they're not either attacked by the Russians or the Syrian army or maybe, you know, ISIS, that type of thing. I mean, these people are there just to serve. They feel a calling to take care of their people. And I would love to document that story.
Photojournalist Mark Hoffman and reporter Mark Johnson are sending updates from their journey to Jordan. You can follow along with those updates at jsonline.com/refugees. If you have a question about their trip, you can submit it on that page as well. Stay tuned in the coming weeks for more audio from their trip. Moving on to our features desk, what do you picture when I say the following words? Dinner party. Is it a casual potluck with friends? Or something that requires a bit more from the host? Food editor Nancy Stowes hosted an old-fashioned dinner party at her house recently. We sat down last week to talk about the experience and the lessons it taught her. All right, Nancy. You wrote a story about a classic dinner party. Now, when I have friends over for dinner, it's usually a pretty casual affair. It's a potluck. You can wear jeans, things like that. What would set my kind of dinner party apart from a more classic dinner party?
Well, a classic dinner party, you would use your best dishes. Don't have to be fine china, but whatever your best is. Real glasses, cloth napkins, tablecloth, cloth tablecloth. So you'd have the table set really nice, and you'd put some thought into the food and make something special. It doesn't have to be fancy, but, you know, you wouldn't just throw something together. And you might send out actual invitations, and you would also put some thought into who you invited and where they should sit for the best mingling.
And why did you want to put together this classic dinner party?
It's been a lot of years since we've done anything like this. When you're first married, you get all this fancy china and you have people over, and you've just gotten away from that. So we've had people over for dinner, but it's not the same thing. So I wanted to see what it was like to do it all out. And for that, we consulted an etiquette expert and some people who've given dinner parties, because it's kind of fallen out of favor and we wanted to bring it back if we could.
Why do you think it's fallen out of favor?
Various reasons. Time is a big one. The perception, at least, that it takes a lot of time and fuss, and people eat out so much now. If they want to get together, they'll go to a restaurant instead of planning a nice dinner at home. And there's still nothing more special than having people over to your home for a meal.
All right. So online, the story, the headline on the story, asks whether or not it's worth it to have a classic dinner party. Having gone through one and done all of the work to throw one, how would you answer that question?
I would have to say yes, it is. People do up their game for something they know you put a lot of trouble into, and that's a little more formal, but not stuffy at all. I probably would not plan such an extensive menu, and I would not feel at all bad about just making lasagna, for example, with a salad. Or the food doesn't have to be fancy. There are lots of choices in how you do your own dinner party.
But the main thing is just getting people together for that conversation.
Yes, and putting a little extra effort into it to make it special.
So if one of our listeners wanted to throw their own classic dinner party, what would be some good initial steps for them to take?
Well, the first thing I would say is go online and read the story. There are many tips there. You would start by thinking of whom to invite and how many, and give them a call. Get their confirmation first before you go ahead and do the planning. And look around for just the right menu. Make sure all your dishes and everything are clean. And take it from there.
Just have fun with it.
Yes, exactly.
That story ran in Wednesday's food section, but you can find it online at freshmke.com. The online package has a ton of information for anyone looking to host a dinner party, including recipes, etiquette tips, and a graphic on how to properly set your table. Not so long ago, notes taken during a doctor's appointment were scrawled on a chart. They were hard to read, and they were not easily transported with patients who visited other providers or emergency rooms. Today, electronic medical records are becoming the norm. They're a technological breakthrough that's helping patients receive better care. Doctors take notes on a laptop or tablet, and those notes follow the patient in a much more efficient fashion. A key player in this field is Epic Systems, which employs thousands of people on a huge campus near Madison. Journal Sentinel business reporter Guy Bolton talks with deputy business editor Jim Nelson about these remarkable changes.
I'm here with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel business news reporter Guy Bolton. And we're going to be talking about electronic medical records, a story that is really important to Wisconsin and Wisconsin's business economy because Epic Systems over in Madison employs thousands of people, and they're a big player in this line of work.
Epic introduced its first electronic health record for large physician practices more than two decades ago. This technology has been around, and in Wisconsin, the health systems were well ahead of their counterparts throughout the country in adopting electronic health records. Now, a lot of the academic medical centers, a lot of the big health systems, Kaiser Permanente in California is a great example, made the move to electronic health records beginning in at the turn of the last century.
It sounds like this practice leads to better outcomes for patients, that patients maybe get healthier and get well quicker in part, or avoid complications because of this technology.
EHRs have lots of critics, but they also can cite hundreds of examples. A story that we will have running Sunday gets into some of those on how electronic health records can transform healthcare, how the protocols and practice guidelines that can be built into these systems can improve the quality of care for patients. There is just simply too much for physicians to remember. Medicine is too complex.
Guy, take a minute and put your thinking cap on. Look 5 years down the road. How's this kind of technology, and how are these new practices going to look 5 years from now?
What often goes unmentioned or gets overlooked in the criticisms of EHRs is this technology is still in the early stages. This is almost like where computers were in the 1980s. Health systems are still building out their computer systems for electronic health records. The systems are going to become easier to use. They're going to become better designed for specific specialties, such as, say, cardiology or ophthalmology. That's taking place now. Going forward, they talk about so-called predictive analysis, analytics, excuse me, where they will be able to identify patients who are at a high risk of, say, a fall or a stroke or readmission to a hospital by being able to look through their electronic health record and see, you know, certain red flags, so to speak, and identify a patient for a doctor or a nurse that this patient needs to be watched for this.
Sounds really interesting. Guy, we'll look forward to your story and thank you for your time.
For more on Guy's story, pick up today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can also find his work online at jsonline.com/business. All right, I'm pretty excited about this next segment. You may have seen this play out on Twitter last week. It's normal for politicians to come in for interviews with our editorial board, but it's pretty unusual for one to walk out and refuse to answer questions. Alderman Bob Donovan is running to be the mayor of Milwaukee. Last week, he showed up to be interviewed by our editorial board, only to leave without answering questions. So, what happened? Here's editorial board members Ernie Franzen and David Haynes with the behind-the-scenes answer.
Hi, this is Ernie Franzen of the Journal Sentinel editorial page. I'm here with David Haynes, editorial page editor, and we want to talk about something that was fairly bizarre this week, at least for us. Alderman Bob Donovan, who is running for mayor, came in for an editorial board meeting on Monday and then did something I had never seen before. He turned around and walked out. Dave, what happened?
Well, I haven't seen it before either, Ernie. Alderman Donovan came in the room and noticed that columnist Dan Bice was in the room. Dan has written a couple of columns that have been quite critical of Donovan, talking about some of his past run-ins with the law. And Donovan took one look at him and said, if he's here, called him a gossip columnist, then I'm not going to be here. And so I explained to the alderman that, as with all our editorial board meetings, they're open to the news side reporters, and they're always on the record. And he said, well, I'm leaving. And I said, well, then you have to make that decision. But you're right, I'd never seen it before either. I think it was a mistake on his part. Not only did I think it was bad form, but he didn't get a chance to explain to us his views on the issues, which is all we really wanted to ask him about.
Now, Donovan has been in for editorial board meetings in the past.
He has.
And he has not, and reporters have been there, so he shouldn't have been surprised.
Right. He should not have been surprised.
And he had not put any stipulations on this meeting, had he?
No. He had not.
Now, generally speaking, we no longer endorse in most political races. Why are we then still meeting with candidates?
Yeah. Our general policy on endorsements is that we don't do political endorsements unless there's something unusual about the campaign or about the election, or we feel strongly about a particular candidate. But we still have the candidates in. For example, during the last gubernatorial election, we had Mary Burke and Scott Walker in, and we did live streamed hour-long interviews with them. We do that because we end up doing editorials on the issues in those campaigns anyway, and we think it's important to reach out to the candidates not only to give them a chance to explain themselves on those issues, but to give our readers a chance to see them under fire, which is important.
Now, do you expect to make any changes as a result of what Donovan did? Make it clear to them, perhaps, that reporters would be there, or would you even consider kicking reporters out of the meeting?
I wouldn't take reporters out. I think that we should always be clear about who's going to be in a room and who isn't.
And I think we were clear in this case.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me that we would need to remind the alderman, and I don't think that was the issue. I'm not sure why he decided to do what he did, but at any rate, no. I think having reporters in the room is important. It's just part of the process. And as I said, these meetings are on the record. The New York Times got into a bit of a pickle recently when they had Donald Trump in apparently for what turned out to at least part of the meeting be an off-the-record meeting. And then he said some things that were reported elsewhere that I think the Times wished they could report at that point. In a candidate interview, I can't imagine us ever going off the record. We have on occasion, rare occasions, but on occasion, with reporters in the room, gone off the record with someone who's come in to see us, but then only if everyone in the room, all the journalists, agree to what the ground rules were, which is super important when you're deciding whether to go off the record.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave, and thanks for listening. This is Dave and Ernie for the editorial board.
Thanks, Ernie.
For more from Ernie Franzen and David Haynes, visit jsonline.com/opinion. I'd also suggest going back and reading columnist Daniel Bice's tweets from that day. Those are available at twitter.com/DanielBice. That's one word, spelled DanielBice. It may go without saying, but there's a lot at stake for Republicans and Democrats in this election cycle. One of the many issues that's playing out right now center around President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland. Will the Republican-controlled Senate give Garland a confirmation hearing? No matter how you answer that question, there may be repercussions for local Republican elections. Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert weighed in on this issue during this week's JSM Politics show. Here's a bit of his chat with David Haynes.
President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to be to replace Antonin Scalia in the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you think is going to happen with that? Any chance that the Republican senators who have stood lockstep against even considering a nomination might change their minds? And where's Ron Johnson on this?
Republican senators have really dug in. I think there are some individual senators that Democrats are hoping to pick off who are up for re-election. Ron Johnson, of course, is up for re-election. He's one of the vulnerable Republican incumbents, but he's been sort of digging in on this as well. You know, one question is whether he'll meet with the nominee. Another question is whether he would, you know, before we even get to the question of whether they'd vote for the nominee, is the question of whether they'd meet with the nominee and whether they'd support having hearings for the nominee. So it'll be interesting to watch Ron Johnson. But I think right now the Republicans, after a little bit of back and forth, have kind of dug in on this because I think they fear a backlash from their own base if they show any wiggle room. And that's where the lines are drawn right now.
So, Craig, quickly, we're almost out of time, but is there any evidence that that issue, the Supreme Court nomination, is playing at all in politics here in Wisconsin?
We just don't know. I mean, we do know from the polling, from some polling that has been done, that, you know, most voters say the Senate should hold hearings. But we don't know whether that's an issue that will affect the way people vote.
Great. Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, thanks so much.
To find more of our political coverage, visit jsonline.com/politics. As always, you can find our full JS on Politics show through iTunes and Stitcher Radio. That does it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Again, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Just a heads up for our avid listeners, we will not have a podcast next week. We're taking a week off during the Easter holiday. Tune in again on Sunday, April 3rd for another look into our newsroom. And take care until then.